kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 63. Is EdTech a Discipline? With me, Doug Belshaw, and...
me, Di Barnes. Good evening, Doug. How are you doing?
All right, thank you. We had a really interesting day yesterday, which I'll talk about in a moment. Yeah, what have you been up to this week?
I've had a busy week. I always forget how many things I've done. I've sent out my digital learning party invitation to all the staff, so I'm creating this little group of people called the Digital Learning Party. Did we talk about that last week?
I think you mentioned you were about to send it, yeah.
Okay, so I sent this. I sort of drafted this remit for this party, and so it had the why, what, where, when, who, what sort of thing. And it's just about teachers having fun, really, with technology in their classrooms, about trying to get some people on board who want to play, want to take risks, want to get it wrong and to get it right, you know. And then I did this sort of funny FAQ section on it, which was all a bit sort of tongue-in-cheek and trying to pull in the right character. So anyway, I had a sort of good response. A dozen or so teachers have replied to that so far, which is great, within 24 hours. What else have I done? Lots of reports done this week, which I did with on speech to text, which was quite good fun. So I spoke my reports, which was really an enjoyable experience. I'm not sure if it was a novelty that made it enjoyable or just it just didn't.
How accurate was it? Just out of interest.
It was pretty good. So there'd be sort of 3 or 4 errors per 500 characters per report. And sometimes it was quite hard to catch the error. You had to be quite careful and had to go a little bit more slowly to make sure that you were reading what came out of the text, if you see what I mean.
As you went along rather than at the end going back and editing, yeah?
No, so I mentally noted, within a 500 character report, there are only comments, they're not really full reports. So within 500 characters, I would read it as I did it to make sure I'd caught the errors mentally. And then when I finished that report, I would go back and do all the corrections for that report with mouse and keyboard.
And do you think that was faster or just a different experience?
I'd have to really time it because I type reasonably quickly and all of that. But what I do get with reports, so what I wasn't tempted to do was copy and paste, which was a good thing. I didn't get frustrated and sort of angry with the work, you know, just like really fed up with the repetitive nature of it. It was always kind of fun because you were talking and then watching your words change from crazy things, and then the computer would work out what you actually said because you finished your sentence. And
were you using Google Docs for that?
So I was using OS X and a dictation tool and going straight into iSAMS into the browser. So that's our MIS and going straight in there. So there's no copying and pasting out of another app. And it was kind of good fun, you know. I'm not sure, you know, whenever you do something new with tech or anything in life, really, it's always got a little feel-good factor about it. So I'm not really sure that it was that. And when I do the next cycle of reports before Christmas, I guess, I will try it again and see whether it, you know, still holds that attraction or not. But it was fun. It was good. I recommend people try it.
Good. So this is you kind of blazing a trail, as it were, because is anyone else at your school doing this? Or would you be the first?
Oh, no, someone else said to me they're not at the school any longer. They were only here for a year, actually. And she had done it and said it was good. And actually, what you need to do is when you're writing reports is to have all your marking done and all your data set up so you know what you're talking about, because there were 90 reports to write. So I did the first 50 typing and the last 40 by speech because I was bored of the typing. So we'll see. We'll give it another go. It's not me blazing trails. And dictation's been around for years. It's just a matter of using it.
Yeah, kind of using it now that it's that kind of thing that Claire Shirley talks about once technology becomes boring, it becomes useful. So,
yeah, I've been teaching about this week. So I had a look at with a couple of classes, I had a look at Google I/O and Google Home, which is, you know, massively voice activated or speech recognition user interface sort of thing. And so we were looking at voice, looking at Google, OK Google on phones and things like that, and what it can do and where it's actually applicable and where it's useful and how it would distinguish between different people's voice patterns when you have one set of microphones listening to a whole family, for example, and that kind of thing. Looking at the implications of that, and I was really critical, actually, of Google's video that they'd made of this family getting ready to go out to work and school and how they used it, because they just got the video wrong. It was quite interesting when you consider how much money they must put into writing these resources.
So I've only seen the one where the family's sitting down for dinner and the mother turns off Wi-Fi so nobody can access the internet.
Okay, that's Google Wi-Fi, which is a new sort of Wi-Fi router extending pods kind of thing.
All right, well, tell us about the one that you've seen.
So the one that I've seen, it just has a family getting up. So it has the father, the mother, the daughter, and the son. And the son is the youngest, and the mother's rearranging dinner dates and sending texts because her aeroplane is going to be delayed. And the father's changing his routes, and the route gets sent from the Google device to his phone because the other one's got traffic on it and things like that. And then the daughter is like whispering into it to get answers for her homework, which she's doing before school. And then the boy ends up getting to, and the dad like controls all the lights and the music in the house and all of that sort of thing. So he turns the light, he tells Google to turn the lights on in his son's bedroom to wake him up. And then the boy gets ready. And the thing I really didn't like about it, there was lots and lots of holes in it, but the thing I really didn't like about it is that this boy rocks downstairs in a spaceman, an astronaut's outfit kind of thing, because he's got a space day at school. And the family are all standing at the door waiting for him. And then they see him in this costume, and the dad, they all look quizzically at him, and the dad says, "Hey Google, what events are there today?" or something like that. "Or what does the calendar say for today?" And it says, "Well, the first event is a big space day at thingamajig." And I just thought, how stupid is that? That this little boy, you know, all of this technology is supposed to, what they should be making it do is manage the notifications, as we've discussed before many times. And what happened in that family with all of this tech going on is that they're not talking to each other. They're talking through the tech all of the time. When the youngest member of that family rocks up at the door in this big costume, rather than the father saying something sensible like, "Aren't I rubbish?" or, you know, or "Screw Google, you didn't tell me my kid had this thing today and I haven't helped him whatsoever get ready for this big day at school." And then the first thing he does is he talks to Google Calendar to see why he's wrong. Do you know what I mean? Hmm. Rather than talking to his son and sort of getting down at his level and going, "Oh my God, aren't I rubbish?"
Di, just to stop you there, you do as a Google advert, not some kind of, you know, like feel-good film.
No, but the point is,
I'm pulling. Like, I think that Apple do this really well. Like, so I was going to mention the Linkrot podcast anyway, that Tim Clapdoor and two mates have started. Lovely designed page, and they've started releasing these podcasts. One of the ones they were talking about was kind of what you're getting at there, and they were using Apple as an example of the difference between here's a bunch of specifications and stuff this thing can do versus, you know, you are a creator, you're an artist, you're a family, this is how it supports your existing life. And what you're describing there is this is how you're going to have to modify your life for new Google technology.
That's it. And they think it's all going to be better. But actually, the message that they're giving out, and this is why I get annoyed, Doug, because I am the face of technology to many people within my bubble. Google should be focusing on the idea of how technology supports people in their lives, not the technology wagging the dog kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it just gets on my nerves.
With the Amazon Echo advert when it first came out in the US. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about that was it was massively satirized by people taking off the soundtrack and doing voiceovers, really kind of family interactions which would just never happen, and treating the Amazon Echo thing as if it was a member of the family and all that kind of stuff. And so I think it's just an example of pretty tone deaf technology advertising, isn't it?
It is. Have you seen, someone recommended to me over the holiday to watch the film Her? You seen that?
No, I haven't. I don't get a chance to watch many films that my wife isn't going to like, to be quite honest.
Well, she is going to like this, right? Really? Tell her completely. Tell her it's not what you think it's going to be. Tell her to watch it.
One where the guy falls in love with his phone or something?
Yeah, it's not what you think it's going to be, Doug. So anyone listening who's not seen it, I didn't watch it for ages because I was...
Is it got like a twist, a bit like Ex Machina?
It's just how the whole thing plays out. Not plays out at the end, but how it plays out in the film.
Right.
The way it's going to set up is not what you think it's going to be. Mm. And it's really, really interesting reflection on being human and on technology and on the way they intersect.
I'll have a look. Do you want to stick the link to the IMDb thing in the show notes?
If you can? Yeah, I will. What have you been up to anyway?
Well, since we last spoke, I have been up some mountains, as I said I was going to, in the Lake District, which was great. So I'll not go into details, you can read the post, but I went up Helvellyn, and I wasn't going to do Striding Edge, which, for those who don't know, is kind of a pretty narrow ridge that goes from Helvellyn back down. There's some climbing involved there, etc. But it was such a lovely day, and there was hardly any wind, and there were lots of people about, that I thought, well, why not? And just had a great time and walked about 10 miles each day. Pretty challenging terrain in times. And yeah, the whole point of it is to get enough days under my belt to be able to do the mountain leader qualification. So I've done 4 days now. I need to do 20 before I get on the course. So still a way to go. But, you know, getting there.
20, is that 20 within a set amount of time or just 20 full stop?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, it has to be a reasonable amount of time. I'm trying to do it within maybe 2 years. It's difficult, as you know, like I've said before, because I have to travel a bit when I'm working. I then kind of need to be away during the weekend, and so it's a bit awkward. But Brian Mathers said he would join me for a walk sometime, and Di, you're very welcome to come along. I'll need to go to Wales and to Scotland and to other areas, so if you fancy that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, no, I'd be up for that.
Yeah.
Do that. I get good holidays. You do it during the holidays. It'd be cool.
Excellent. Let's go do it afterwards. The other thing we've done, so we're recording this on Thursday this week, because of the reports you just mentioned. And what we did yesterday, what a great day, we did We Are Open Co-op Day for October. So we're setting aside a day every month, and John Bevan, Laura Hilliger, Brian Mathers and myself, who are the members of We Are Open Co-op at the moment, met together to talk about all different kinds of stuff. And so I wrote that up this morning, including some of Brian's wonderful diagrams and illustrations, and just went through kind of five themes. Well, the fifth one is things we didn't get to. So the four things were, we talked about workflow, and we used something which I think you've seen in our Slack channel, which is Pombot, which is a Pomodoro timer within Slack. And you'll have to look at the screenshot to see what that is for people who haven't seen that. The other thing was, you know, I'm a big fan of Trello, using a template to make sure that we've got everything we need for clients. Talked about membership conditions and benefits, and I'll not go into that because it's quite complex and you can read that. Third thing, we talked about maybe diversifying beyond the Thinkathon into workshops and other things. Then the fourth one was business development, and Brian drew this wonderful thought grenade. So in the same way that designers sometimes design things on spec, like redesign Wikipedia or redesign Facebook, and then they get some traction and people go, oh, that's wonderful, I must give you some work. That kind of thing, lobbing an idea into an organization and seeing what happens.
Cool. So what didn't you do?
So the fifth thing, we did want to have a plan for working with other co-ops. There's Educators Co-op in the US, or a bunch of great guys. And we said we were going to start doing some work with them, and we haven't really figured out what that is, and we were going to get onto that. We didn't get time. There's the cooperative conference next year. The closing day for proposals is the 28th of October. We didn't get around to that. And then, as you'll see in the how we're going to let people into our co-op, there's a financial model that we need to figure out. Brian and John were going to sort out a spreadsheet for that, and I think they're going to go away and do that, because it impacts on how we structure that engagement. So, you know, especially in tech, people talk about hiring people slowly and firing them quickly.
Yeah.
Similar kind of thing for the co-op. Like, we want to get to know people. There's not going to be any firing involved, but we want to get to know people over a period of time. And so we thought about creating badges around openness. So a couple of years ago, I created this manifesto for working openly on the web, and maybe creating badges around that. Then there's going to be some kind of buy-in, so a financial kind of thing. But the most important thing is that we know that these people can run thinkathons and workshops in a way that we'd want. So it might take a few months for people to join the co-op, and they have to be a limited company beforehand. But we're just trying to figure out so that maybe by early 2017, we can start admitting additional members.
Cool.
So yeah, today, there's been a lot of stuff going around over the last week or so about whether EdTech is a discipline. And I think that's what we've decided to talk about tonight, haven't we?
Yes. It's a good topic. It's an interesting thing, I think, and since we're called today in digital education, and this is very relevant.
Oh, it is. So it started off as an article, and this was on a thing called Campus Technology, and it was why it's time for education technology to become an academic discipline. And Martin Weller picked up on this. I'm not really particularly interested, I don't know about you, in the original post, because it was just rah, 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 we need more structure and stuff. And what I'm interested in is the people who I know and respect, like Martin and Audrey and other people, thinking about this kind of stuff. So I don't know if you've had a chance to look at Martin Weller's post and Audrey's and some stuff that I've written, but I think there's a lot of nuance in here, and there's definitely arguments to be made for and against, and I'm quite persuaded by both sides, to be quite honest.
Well, I found, so in looking at this, I've read your article in detail, and when you published it, and I haven't read the other two in any detail.
Okay.
But I will look through them. I am looking through them now. But I wasn't quite sure what to think, other than my role. So I'm the head of digital strategy for education in a school of 1,100 pupils. And there are many organizations like this up and down the country. And my job's been called all sorts of things over the years. And this school have decided to create a post with my job title, which is essentially in charge of ed tech kind of thing, is the real thing that I do. So everything that pupils and teachers use to lubricate and enhance what they do in the classroom, that is technological, is my gig. And it's to have some kind of structure to that is sort of important. So at the moment, my credentials for that post are based on my online presence, I think. You know, it's based on the work that I do, like this podcast, although I wasn't doing it when I got the job, but we did do EdTech Roundup and Twitter and blog posts, other social media things, and just getting involved, teach meets on, you know, that kind of on conference thing, and that kind of thing, and just being understanding technology and showing that I do so. But it wasn't about, so my credentials qualification wise, sort of CV wise, if you like, were more that I had experience working in the field. I came here to teach computer science. I've never taught computer science before and only have an O level in it. And that sort of thing. So it wasn't based on my teaching as such, I wouldn't have thought, although they would just take that that was at a good standard. And I did teach a lesson on it at interview, which was very good. So a lot of people I know have done qualifications in education technology, but they're sort of MAs, and they tend to specialize in one thing. Like I know somebody who became an IT teacher after they'd done an MA in interactive whiteboards, you know, didn't really fit. But they did a good job and they learned their stuff and worked hard. So it would be good to have some sort of structure or recognition for education technology as a discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do like your points that you say where you would rather it be called a field, I think, in your post.
Yeah, and some people in the comments to Martin Weller's post have said that maybe it's a research domain. So the interesting place to start for me is always people think they're talking about the same thing when actually they might be talking past each other. So even just the very obvious thing that Martin comes from the UK, Audrey comes from the US, even the fact that we use EdTech as a shorthand because it gets past the problem that in the UK we tend to talk about educational technology, and in the US they tend to talk about education technology, are two nouns there rather than the way that we put it. Adverb, is it? I'm not sure. So, and then what I've tried to say is that, so Martin is tentatively, I would say, for having a discipline of EdTech. Audrey is very much against, and I'm kind of like, oh, I think it's have some benefits, but we should call it a field rather than a discipline. So just to kind of summarize what Martin's saying, he's saying three things, really. He says, firstly, EdTech as a discipline allows us to bring in a range of perspectives. One of the criticisms of EdTech is that people come in from one discipline and are unaware of fundamental work in a related one. End of quote. And that's often the thing in educational technology, isn't it? Like, people stumble into it from other things. Like, I came into it from history, and other people come into it from languages or a health background or whatever it is. And there's no problem with that. It's just that quite often you've done a lot of your studying by the time you get there, and then you're not aware of what's gone before, me included. Second thing, it says, another criticism of EdTech is that it lacks rigor. Claims are often based on anecdotes, small trials, or just hopes about the power of technology. And the third one, he talks about, it creates a body against which criticism can push. And he talks about the fact that he's doing an art history master's at the moment, and makes a roundabout point about, basically, if you've got this body of knowledge, then there's something you can critique it. Whereas at the moment, we don't know where the boundaries are. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Audrey, I think, and again, as I said in my post, I'm always wary of disagreeing with Audrey because it usually means I don't know what I'm talking about. she's a very smart, very opinionated woman.
So, she's very smart. She is.
I actually wrote in that post that I'm pretty scared of her and then deleted it because that sounds ridiculous, but she is quite scary. And just in her being so, I don't know, just like some people are just so full of knowing what they're about. You know what I mean? She feels that herself, but that's...
Yeah, I think she feels extremely, when I read her work or listen to her keynotes, which I have done on several occasions, not in person, sort of on recordings online, I have felt that she's very well read and very well thought through, and that's important. You know, she connects things. She seems to be quite broad in her church of knowledge, if you like, and able to connect all the pews inside, kind of thing.
So when Audrey says that, she talks about her keynote last week, she says, we need a radical blasphemy, a greater willingness for undisciplining. She thinks that the field of edtech is already too disciplined, and she uses Michel Foucault, Discipline and Punish, and talks about how academic disciplines grew in the 18th century alongside the establishment of the modern prison, etc., etc., etc. She says, quote, education technology is already a discipline. Education technology is already disciplinary. That is its history, that is its design, that is its function, end of quote. I don't feel that. And maybe it's because I'm not as embedded in the field, or maybe it's because I'm based over here in the frozen wastelands of the north of east of England, or whatever it is. But to me, and the point I was trying to make in my post, is that, first of all, you know, words matter, and I don't think discipline is a good word. I wouldn't use it for anything that I do, but I certainly would use the word field or research area or whatever it is. So, as I've already mentioned to you before, Di, I think that it helps create career paths. If you start looking at where the boundaries are, you don't draw a hard boundary and say, this is the field of ed tech and nothing else can go within it. But you have an area of focus. And, you know, you said that you're head of digital strategy. I've been director of e-learning. I've done stuff at Mozilla and JISC and independently and all different things in schools. But what I've never had is a career path, because what we do isn't a discipline. It's not really a field. It doesn't have a structure to it, which means that you have to find your way around the cracks of stuff that already exist between education and technology and other disciplines and fields which are already there, which isn't really fair. If you want edtech to be your thing, you don't want to be always looking for the little cracks in between stuff. Sometimes you want, I want this job, and then I want a job which pays more money and has more responsibility, and then the one after that. And I don't feel like we've got that in edtech, and I think that would actually be a good thing.
I think it would be. I think it's quite interesting. So the point Martin picks on about MAs, and this sort of echoes what I said about them, and indeed what you did, I think, is that you go and do an MA and you sort of specialize in a niche or area of research or whatever, but you don't have to go and read about educational technology application research, what works, what doesn't work, or, you know, a set number of texts. So, you know, there's no textbook, as it were, for education technology kind of thing. It's all a little bit sort of fly by night, isn't it? And that's why I think it gets given to people who have proven records of success integrating technology in the first instance into their classroom, possibly in the second into their department, and it making a difference, making sort of visible change, if you like, it would be helpful. So what I find is that, you know, you talk to people about education technology and it's like, well, you need to follow this person and read these blogs and do this, that and the other. But there's no Bible of ed tech. You know, there's no set of books or whatever that you could go and do that are going to get you on it. It's kind of like it's kind of a bit like riding a river really on a raft, you know. You kind of just
I think Audrey would say, from what she said in her post, that there not being a Bible of ed tech is a good thing. Like, we don't want any more of that stuff. We want there, you know, to keep it weird and open and all that kind of stuff. And I definitely am sympathetic with that. I just feel like if it's too amorphous, it's invisible to people. And all they see is the shiny surface from vendors, and they see that as EdTech. Mark Smithers wrote a post, comment on Martin Weller's post. He said, "Just as an aside, in the last year, I've started to describe myself as a critical educational technologist in my Twitter bio, because I thought that the term educational technologist on its own meant being lumped in with the happy-clappy technologists for whom EdTech can do no wrong, as well as those rent seekers that try and profit from EdTech in the worst possible way," end quote.
Interesting. I sell myself as a discerning user of EdTech, and I always will, because I do think there is a lot of bullshit out there that you have to understand is exactly that, and I think a lot of that is the corporate-driven thing. One of the things, and I'd love, if, I mean, Audrey, if you're listening, to know what Audrey's experience of EdTech is, herself as a learner, as an educator, has she used it, and how she found it to enhance what she's doing. Has it brought any traction with her students or indeed herself as a learner, and kind of thing? Because I think when you look at EdTech from afar, so you remember I said I met Dick Taylor, who listens to Tide, I believe, for coffee, tea, a few weeks ago. Very nice cup of tea. Thank you, Dick. And he has he's an investor in EdTech companies, and he's invested in 5 startups, I think. And he sees the EdTech world in a very different way to that how I see it. You know, I kind of see it from the ground and looking at working with people to change or to bring new things into their classroom. And into the pupils' hands and their process of learning as well, and he doesn't see it like that at all. He kind of sees it as companies, and he knows very much the big players who are getting the big contracts and the million-pound things and whatever. And so I wonder. So for me, if you're talking about that corporate world that he described, if you're talking about that as EdTech, that's not EdTech to me. EdTech to me is something within every school, but my knowledge of it is within the school that I'm working in and you know, dealing with. So I need to have a foot inside technological expertise, so I need to understand the parameters of different services and devices and hardware and software and sort of thing, and then I need to understand what goes on in a classroom and the interaction between a teacher and their pupils and the differences that there can exist in both of those fields, you know.
So we're a couple of white guys, and I think that Maha Bali, who is an Egyptian educator, obviously a woman of colour, she, you know, pushes back pretty strongly on Martin Weller's blog in the comments section. It's worth noticing, it's worth mentioning that Audrey doesn't have a comment section, which is, you know, entirely up to her, and because of the abuse and the Gamergate stuff and everything like that. And I am insanely jealous of Martin Weller getting 35 comments on his blog. I used to get that back in the day, and now nobody comments on my stuff. But hey, I'm not bitter. But Maha Bali says that basically people... She talks about positivism, which is, you know, the idea that things exist that can be scientifically verified. So it rejects things like metaphysics and theology and spiritualism, all that kind of stuff. She says, you know, the kind of white male positivist approach to the world will always be foregrounded when you create a discipline, and it kind of, it's ahistorical because it gets rid of all of the stuff that's happened before. So there was a great thing, and I might see if I can find the link. So Steve Wheeler was pretty much eviscerated by people on Twitter in Stephen Downs' OL Daily, because he interviewed what he called the founding fathers of online educators, 3 old white guys. And I'm sure he didn't mean anything bad by it, but not only was it not correct, but it also, like, obviously really foregrounded male privilege. So it's difficult for me to understand this because I'm insanely privileged as a white male, and I don't really understand all of the problems and all that kind of stuff. So I'm always having to read and understand and find out how people who are underprivileged find themselves repressed and hard done by, especially by people like myself, how I can help with that kind of thing. A really interesting thing came up yesterday, actually, while I'm talking about this. So we were talking about the cooperative, and we're trying to think about ways in which we could allow people in. And I came up with, well, why don't we make it so that someone has to, like, have sold a thinkathon or sold a bit of co-op business, a workshop or whatever, before they can come in. And Laura, I don't think she'd mind me saying this, pushed back on that and said, well, that's not really fair because it's not a level playing field. Like, people of colour, women, stuff like, just don't get listened to as much as men. So men are always going to find it easier to sell that kind of stuff. Okay. So I definitely don't know what I don't know about privilege and drawing boundaries around stuff when it's not really fair. One of the things we're going to talk about tonight, which we'll probably punt to another week, is meritocracy, and I feel like it fits into this. When somebody else provides the filter is always, when you provide the filter is always going to benefit you. And if you're in a privileged position, then you're hardly going to make it so that you're not privileged, and that kind of perpetuates in society. Anyway, that's a very long way of saying that there's many, many layers to what's going on here.
Well, let's have a look at, I'm going to read one of Mahabali's comments on Martin's post. Okay, it's quite long, bear with me. Oh, come on. Critical ed tech has existed for years. It's done daily by people like the Ed C. MOOC folks, Sean Bain, Jen Ross, Knox et al., people who push the edges of what ed tech could be, Dave Cormier, or look critically at all that, Francis Bell. It's right that it's right there and called critical digital pedagogy by us in the hybrid pedagogy community. It's the work of people like Bonnie Stewart and Catherine Cronin and Kate Bowles, and by women, how women and people of color push back against mainstream positivist ed tech, for example, Audrey Watters, Sava Singh, Sherry Spelek, and indeed herself. As I posted on Brian's blog, I have no idea what's missing for ed tech to count as a discipline, except for someone to start excluding these alternative perspectives and start restricting the kinds of research we are allowed to do, respectively do. Oh, wait, that's already the case. Everyone will cite the white men of EdTech and occasionally recognize other voices exist. Also, methodologies such as collaborative autoethnography will find great difficulty getting published on EdTech, just because. Oh, because it's a field dominated by men and therefore by scientific/positivist sensibilities, where more interpretive/critical approaches are considered less rigorous. I don't know what calling it a discipline would achieve, but all I have outlined above already exists and happens. Oh, and I have a master's degree in e-learning. I don't know what it is needed for, what is needed for something to be called a discipline. You said all of the things seem to be in place, journals, conferences, associations, etc., worldwide and not just in the US and the UK. So it's quite interesting. There are, obviously are a lot of organizations and associations and writing going on and all of that. And one of the things quite clearly is that some people aren't being listened to and being dismissed quite early. You know, you know what I mean? Rather than heard out and countered, it's a difficult thing. Everything is in place. It is a discipline.
Well, Kate, just to, I mean, one of the people that Maha Bali says is Kate Bowles. I'm just going through the comments here. She says, "I'm with Maha on this one. When the gain from disciplinarity turns out to be a shared who's who and a consensus around ideas that matter, we overlook an entire history of subaltern thinking about who always gets left out when the lists are made." Because lists belong to someone, and conferences belong to someone, and professional associations belong to someone, and when we Venn diagram it all, the same people get waitlisted because first everyone has to get through the A list. End of quote. So I think a lot of people are there's very valid points being made in here and stuff which I have not. It's not a lived experience for me, and also this is a very academic point of view, I think. But also, I think that there's a lot of angst and a lot of frustration being expressed here, especially in the comments section. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes, because it'll be interesting. And I can see both points of view, but, you know, in the work that I do, especially around ambiguity, I feel like EdTech is unproductively ambiguous as a term. So in my thesis... Sorry.
Let me just pick up on that point of ambiguity. One thing I think would be helpful in this talk of it being a discipline is not necessarily the perception of people. So it looks like there's a lot of sort of infighting going on here in the post we just looked at, or in the comments of that. But that there is ambiguity within organizations as to what EdTech is, what it should be, and who they should appoint to look after it. You know, what kind of weight the people who are appointed should carry to do that. So some schools will see this as a member of the senior leadership team will have the EdTech responsibility, and but they will need the knowledge with which to manage that. And others will see it as we just need toys in the classroom. Let's get some toys in the classroom. Who knows how to do that kind of thing? Oh, that teacher there, they've done some. Let's put them on it. But until the field of EdTech is seen as something that must be addressed by someone who knows what they're doing, which needs to be proven somehow, then it's always going to be struggling. And so what I'm trying to say is the identity of EdTech in the eyes of those who are not expert in it. So if you want your car fixing, you go and find a mechanic who is qualified, a mechanic in your vehicle, preferably. And and that sort of thing. If you want a lawyer, you go to an appropriate lawyer who's specialized. You want a doctor, you go to the appropriate doctor who's specialized in that particular area or whatever. And EdTech is like not seen like that at all. It's kind of seen as though someone can be pushed into it. Do you know what I mean? No, they're quite good at that. Let's go and do it. And that's not how it works, really. I think that's where this comes from. I think critical education technology and educational technology are the same thing. I think every educational technologist worth their salt is going to have a critical eye if they're going to be effective.
The thing I think, so a couple of things. First of all, I completely missed the comments that Julian Wood had put on my blog. For some reason, I didn't get the notification. He agrees with the kind of point I made in passing about the fact that if you're not in academia, you just get you just get ignored, basically. So, you know, Audrey spends a lot of time in universities doing stuff, so she is seen as part of the academic milieu. And obviously Martin is, he's a professor of educational technology. So I think the ironic thing is even that comments section is people in a bubble talking to each other, you know. And I'm not particularly bothered if my posts aren't referenced, but I know other people like Tim Clapdoor and some other people who, even though they're kind of in higher education, they don't get mentioned as much, perhaps because they're in Australia, I don't know. But Julian's making the point that he feels a bit left out when the whole conversation around EdTech happens because he doesn't work in academia, even though he's got skills and research and all that kind of stuff going on. He sent me this thing once around third spaces and learning, using this method from Italy, the Reggio Emilia stuff, and it was just great. Not only had he researched it amazingly well and worked in collaboration with people, but produced this pack and this wonderful thing. And often that kind of work is overlooked. But the point I wanted to make about ambiguity is that this kind of Greek word, zeugma, which I use in my thesis, which was introduced by my supervisor, and what he means is that you're never sure which part of a phrase is emphasized. So with education technology or ed tech, you're not sure whether it's the ed or the tech which is being foregrounded. Is it education technology or is it education technology? Because it makes a big difference as to where the emphasis is. Because if it's just education as a modifier for technology, then, you know, it's vendors first. Whereas if it's education, and that's the important thing, the pedagogy, technology, then you can see where the biases are there too. So I guess after this conversation, I'm actually more on the fence than I was before. But I think there's some value in making it more productively ambiguous as a field. Certainly not nailing it down to be a dead metaphor, as Richard Rorty would say.
Mm.
I also find it, I mean, to be fair, Audrey goes in and talks about Foucault and you know, mentions that in terms of this is why this thing that I'm talking about is important. But in the comments section of Martin's blog, like, people are throwing around Bourdieu and stuff, as, you know, almost like as a posturing thing, which is the worst side of academia to me.
I see. I think I operate so far away from that academic field in that way. I kind of, and that's where I want to keep it. I like what I do, and I like how I do it, and I have to be creative and to riff off ideas, and as well as practice, but and know other people's practice and work with people, and I really enjoy that. And EdTech is a very human thing, as far as I'm concerned, and therefore I would always fall down on the education side. Right, it's more important than the technology side, but understanding the technology is incredibly important. Also, as in, because you need to know the field of play, you need to know what the limitations are, how difficult it is to put iPads into a classroom and make something happen. But the point is that you put the tech in place and you make it work, but then all the work needs to be done with the people, not with the tech. Do you see what I mean?
No, you're right, and yeah, absolutely. I think we lose that sometimes. There's another link I've put in here, and I haven't read it in full because it is 30,000 words. But it's entitled "Toward Constructive Technology Criticism" by Sarah M. Watson on CJR. It's the Tau Center for Digital Journalism, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism. But the reason I put it in, apart from the fact that I want to get on and read it, you can actually download a PDF version of the report, is because of the introductory quotation by someone called Langdon Winner, who I've never come across. Again, it's a long one, but I want to segue into a slightly philosophical thing, which was on Philosophy Bites, about the role of criticism, especially when it comes to technology. So you can tell me to shut up when I've finished, but I think this is important. So, quote, "This is a work of criticism. If it were literary criticism, everyone would immediately understand the underlying purpose is positive. A critic of literature examines a work, analysing its features, evaluating its qualities, seeking a deeper appreciation that might be useful to other readers of the same text. In a similar way, critics of music, theatre and the arts have a valuable, well-established role, serving as a helpful bridge between artists and audiences. Criticism of technology, however, is not yet afforded the same glad welcome. Writers who venture beyond the most pedestrian, dreary conceptions of tools and uses to investigate ways of which technical forms are implicated in the basic patterns and problems of our culture are often greeted with the charge that they're merely anti-technology or blaming technology. All who have recently stepped forward as critics in this realm have been tarred with the same idiot brush, an expression of the desire to stop a much-needed dialogue rather than enlarge it. If any readers want to see the present work as anti-technology, make the most of it. That's their topic, not mine." End of quote. Which I thought was really interesting. There's lots of stuff, you know, Nicholas Carr, who's been a critic, Susan Greenfield for all her craziness. Who else? Plenty of people who have criticised technology and the internet and that kind of stuff. And I guess what this is saying is we need critics to not only for the negative but for the positive. Anyway, so I saw that, and then I was listening in the gym to Philosophy Bites, which is a wonderful podcast. If you listen to only one other podcast than this one, dear listeners, then listen to this one. And this one was Noel Carroll on criticism, and what he's trying to talk about in this particular one is that criticism, it has to involve some level of evaluation, and he is concerned that critics tend these days to leave evaluation out of it and tend to be more explanatory. And so when I think of critic in terms of technology, I think of Audrey Waters, and she's often seen as being, you know, she describes herself as EdTech's Cassandra, and seen by some people as being quite negative, but actually she talks about positive things and how things can be different, and, you know, the wonderful side of things, like, you know, reclaiming your own domain and identity on the web, and and all that kind of stuff. A bit like Cory Doctorow, you know, he criticizes DRM, but he talks about how things can be different in the commons, etc. So for me, a constructive technology criticism points out all of the hidden sides of things, especially in terms of technology. It might involve some kind of negative element, but the whole point is because you have much, you know, you talk about education technology as being a human thing. It's because the people who are doing the criticism have a much larger version of what could be possible using the technology, and they're lamenting the fact that the technology is being used for such pedestrian, small-minded things, which are making us less human rather than more human, if that makes sense.
I think that's right. So I'd say that as well about Audrey, and what I said about her earlier is that I always get a sense that she is a supporter of technology. So in the critique, and she does critique big style, but I do get a sense that that's that. And what I always feel when faced with such critique personally is I don't feel disparaged by it because I think it is a human thing. It is about people. The use of technology is about people. It's not about some kind of Blade Runner style utopia or whatever. It's about people, and it's quite a warm thing, really. It's not a cold thing of machines. It's about enhancing the relationships between people, allowing more people to shine within a given environment, and that kind of thing. You know, to show themselves, express themselves, and to achieve well. Well, that's what I think it's about.
That's why I think that Mark Smithers' quote, going back to that comment on Martin Waller's blog, was really interesting about how he tries to distance himself from the happy-clappy, he didn't use this term, but kind of techno-determinists. People who say, well, look what Facebook and Google and Apple have brought out, so in the future this is going to happen. And that really pisses me off when people do that, when they say, this thing exists, therefore this is how we're all going to be in the future, without realizing that actually these things that have been created have to be appropriated, have to be understood, have to fit into particular cultural sensibilities. What we certainly don't want is this technocratic future where people who have a certain engineering mindset become almost like Platonic kings and get to choose how to structure society.
Yes, indeed. I like the quote from this long quote that you've read by Langdon Winner as well. It's just the idea that anti-technologists, or those that are blaming technology for it being at fault for A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and all the sins of the world, I just don't have time for that. My critique of technology is about how to use it well, not how not to use it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think, I'm helping that school in Jersey and, kind of getting back into the mindset of, to a lesser extent than the kind of world that you inhabit day to day. And you need to have that critical sense of what are we doing here? But when the rubber hits the road, it's never a question of are we going to use this or not? It's how are we going to use and how can we use in a productive way? So, yeah, there is that as well. Okay, have we squeezed this particular topic dry, do you think?
I think we haven't. I think it could be squeezed more, but I think we're done.
Okay, cool. Today. Well, let's move on to the... And if people are listening to this, I know that Tim Clapdoor has written a long post on this, and he listens to this. If you've written a post on EdTech as a discipline, if you are interested in this and would like to write one, if you have any comments... tweet us, get in touch with us, and let us know what you think. We'd be very interested in what you have to say. So what do we have in the last bit, the miscellaneous section?
We have... Let me talk. So I've been doing a talk this week on... talks at the moment to PSHE people, children, upper six, about their online profiles, basically. And so I was there, and one of my pupils, one of my computer science students from the upper six, was in the audience. And I was talking about really what I want them to do is get them to look at their social media profiles from the point of view of an outsider. They're universities. They're all doing UCAS entrance at the moment. And if their universities employ somebody to go and do a sort of online profile rating of them, what's it going to look like, you know? And are they aware of that? How locked down is everything? What can be seen, what can't be seen? Are the odd swear words in there? That sort of thing. And so I know that this pupil who has a Twitter account, and he also has a business, and he has written the PHP engine for the Fifth Gear website and the Gadget Show website. So he doesn't do the front end, he does the back end that feeds all the data to them. But yeah, it's really impressive. He has his own business and lots of clients and such like. And he's a very good programmer, very good technologist. So he went away and he wrote a tool that would clean, that would identify all the list of swear words in your Twitter feed and delete the tweets. So he's called it a Twitter cleanser and put it up on GitHub. Which is, it's kind of cool.
So the situation is, you're about to go to university. Your Twitter account is open. Either recently or in the dim and distant past, you know that you've sworn on Twitter, you've talked about whatever, and you'd have to manually go back through all of your Twitter feed, but instead you can now apply this filter and it will delete the tweets that you don't want.
That's right. So we'll identify tweets and according to a list of keywords and get them off your timeline.
Wow.
It's a nice idea, isn't it? And so he's gone and done that. And it is good because people are encouraged to kind of behave a little bit badly on Twitter. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So I would never behave badly on Twitter. I'd never swear on there, or very rarely. I'd never use really bad swear words, if you see what I mean. Even in those moments. But I would swear in real life and do happily. It's quite interesting. Whereas my knowledge of this young man is completely the other way around. He wouldn't swear in real life, but he's there swearing on Twitter. and I knew he'd done that. So I don't follow any of my pupils, but I all put them, everyone I know that has a Twitter account, I put them in a list, which is public. So they know that I put them in it, but just so I can see how they're using it, and I can talk to them, and some of them talk to me on Twitter, I reply to them and whatever. So I knew he was doing this, and it was just really great that he went and wrote this tool. I mean, it's what happens when your pupils can code, I guess. I don't know.
Excellent.
So it was great. Anyway.
Good. All right. Well, that young person will, like a lot of young people, and have to sit a lot of examinations. So this post on Aon called The Examined Life, subtitle, Students are working harder than ever to pass tests, but schools allow no time for true learning in the Socratic tradition. It's a medium-length post, verging on long, but basically it's talking about how the more tests we have, the more teaching the test that has to happen, because there's only a certain amount of time, and therefore we're not teaching people to think. And it talks about philosophical education, which, as somebody with a degree in philosophy, obviously I think is important. I have to say, though, as I've got older, I find Socrates more and more annoying.
I don't think you're alone. I feel I have the space in my classroom to do this, but I maybe sacrifice it because I have different standards to other people, to other teachers, I think. So I do teach the test very specifically. So those doing exams, we'll do lots of exam questions, and we'll look at mark schemes, and we'll analyze what it is, the structure of the language that's required, and what needs to be included to secure marks, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll do a lot of that. And I see that as my obligation, my duty, because these children have come to me to set a qualification, and that's not my choice or my control. However,
well, also their parents have paid a lot of money for them to be there and get certain grades.
Yes, but I don't teach any better here than I did at a school where that didn't happen, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
But I will always try and fold in to my lessons, to every lesson, I think, something that's really funny, because I want my pupils to leave my classroom feeling better than when they arrived as people, and something interesting from the world, that's relevant but not going to help them with an exam at all, but it's going to holistically I don't want to say open their eyes, it sounds like I'm being some kind of weirdo, like I'm a preacher sort of thing, but it's not like that. It's something that is, you know, let's turn it on its head, let's look at this thing, let's get your opinions out in the room and let's look at them and what do you think about this and what do you think about that, and but have you thought about this and have you thought about that? Or I've always thought this, am I wrong? You know, and I'll put myself up to be squashed as well as looking at how their opinions might not have seen the whole rainbow, if you like, and that kind of thing. So I'm a big fan of the idea of education in a very sort of altruistic manner, not being about passing the exam, but being about connection between people and discussion about difficult things, maybe, or trying to see how something that is not what it appears and that kind of thing. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. I mean, the thing which... There's a wonderful quotation in here about people who haven't been in schools recently not really knowing to what extent schools are like exam factories, and it's easy to overblow this kind of stuff. But let's just read this bit and see if you recognize this in any of the schools you've been in. So, the author is... Oh, where is it? John Taylor, who's Director of Learning, Teaching and Innovation at Cranley Boarding School in Surrey, where he also directs the Philosophy in Education project.
I've met him.
Have you?
Yeah. All right.
Quote, if you are not a teacher yourself or haven't recently talked to children about their experience of school, you will be shocked by the extent to which the teach-to-the-test culture has suffused education. In one survey of the attitudes of university staff, this mentality was discussed in withering terms. A lack of curiosity and sheer love of investigation were noted, and traced back to an underlying approach to schooling that reduces learning to test preparation, defined as a joyless little bean counter approach, whereby students think that learning is simply a matter of knowing the right answer. This, it was noted, was not confined simply to one set of examinations, but was embedded in the entire education system. End of quote.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think it's interesting because, is it true? It's not true of the school I'm in at the moment. It's not true of the school I was in beforehand. It's not really true of, before that, they were both independent schools. Before that, I worked in very challenging state schools in London for 10 years. Hmm. And in a very challenging school, it's not about that either. I mean, it is about going through their qualifications, and the sort of the classroom education is about that. But there's a lot of other stuff going on in the school on top of that, you know, of looking after people and looking after children who've got things really tough, socioeconomic, you know, so they have a day off. It's because they've gone, had to go to hospital with their mum because their mum doesn't speak English, or they've had to go it's a party day because dad's getting out of prison, or whatever it might be, things like that, or you know, their third foster mother has kicked them out of the house age 13 because they're just screaming and shouting and smashing furniture, or what, you know what I mean? The people with really, really difficult situations like that, and you provide, you know, and they're looked after and they're cared for as much as you can do within a school, I think, and amazing work. I've worked with amazing people, both children and teachers in that situation. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't say, even in a school like that, you know, that it's really all about pushing for the tests. Although here, there is a high expectation of doing... of getting the exam results, you know, because the exam results are so very good. But also we have courses here called Trivium, and now Quadrivium has started in our sixth form, which are not examined at all and are done just for the sheer love of learning and nothing else. And the topics that are taught are written, you know, schemes of work are written by the teachers about something that they're knowledgeable about or they want to find out about themselves. Mm-hmm. And they go and write the scheme of work and then they deliver it to the class that they have for a year, and it's all based around
but even that, you know, they devise a scheme of work and they teach it and stuff. Like, it's a very structured, formalistic way of doing it. I'm reminded of, you know, I've just talked about wonky comment sections and quoting French philosophers, but I'm going to do that here. Guy Debord, who talks about society of the spectacle, you know, if you ever get to read that kind of stuff, he talks about how the spectacle is everywhere and everything goes through the spectacle. And, you know, it's kind of a mixture of capitalism and commercialism and alienation and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But there's a certain logic to schools these days, isn't there? I don't know what it was like before, because it was like that a bit when I was younger, and it's got even more like that now, as far as I can see with my own children. And it reminds me of a post from early this year by Katarina Fake, who was one of the co-founders of Flickr. And she wrote something called Teachers Dislike Creative Children. She says, quote, "The characteristics that teachers value in the classroom are those associated with the lowest levels of creativity. Teachers want students to be responsible, reliable, dependable, clear-thinking, tolerant, understanding, peaceable, good-natured, moderate, steady, practical, and logical. Creativity is not moderate or logical. It is associated with characteristics such as determined, independent, and individualistic, people who make up the rules as she goes along, divergent rather than conformist ways of thinking." And she cites some research, end of quote.
Yeah, I kind of don't recognize that much, really. So I kind of think, yeah, no, it's, I mean, it is, there is a certain element by which everyone has to sit down, shut up, and do some work at some point. And I don't plan my lessons like that, so it's quite difficult. I don't do that. I'm always looking for someone who's got a bit of spark, got an interesting idea to take something off in a different tangent. I'm never precious about what I've planned to have done in the classroom, particularly. There'll be certain things that I am precious about. So there'll be certain tests, for example. Let's see how well you've learned this stuff and how well you can, you know, that sort of teaching to the test element of what I have to do. But there'll be...
So I'm not trying to criticize you here, Di, and
I'm just reflecting.
I think there's a certain logic to education that allows you to do that, because it allows you to like give people that free space to like be themselves, but you can very quickly pull them back in because you're just returning them back to the default logic of school.
Yes, but here you're talking about. Completely. But if you're talking about that, you're talking about things that we've talked about before. You know, it's like if you're going to radically rethink schools, you kind of end up with children being back in their families to a certain extent, being back in small communities where all the adults are looking out for them, and you know, the adults all have their jobs, and a lot of their jobs is looking after the children and making sure, you know, they pass on their skill sets and tell their stories around the campfire or whatever, that kind of approach. And at the end of the day, when you're dealing with a sort of a scarce set of resources to bring 1,000 children into a place and get them through a structured day that is going to, you know, they have to go somewhere and be somewhere at a certain time, and we always know where they are. And
well, so that's you said, I'm not here to argue with you, Di, but you said a scarce set of resources. What's scarce?
Adults, generally speaking. The idea being is that, you know, you take, so when you rethink a school, I think the way that you do things in, will you ever get away from the idea you're going to have a group of young people and put one single old person? Do you know what I mean? Do you ever get away from that? And I think what tends to happen in some examples of good teaching is that the adult will allow the children to have sort of more ownership over what they're doing, be more trusting of them, and that kind of thing, and allow, you know, when there is a sort of tangent presented, that they allow that to go away. And yes, the structure of a school, the bell goes, you've got to move on. You can't just continue with it. You're expected somewhere else, and it's somebody else's turn to do that because they are the subject expert in the discipline that you're studying.
Exactly. Like you can be very creative in art or poetry or creative writing from 2 o'clock till 3 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon. Like, it doesn't.
I don't know. My student went and wrote a thing that deleted his swearing tweets. It's not. it's not, you can't say it's not creative. I don't know where, you know, I don't know what to say about that really. It's kind of difficult because I am a teacher and I work in a school, and the schools have been the same for the 45 years I've been on the planet. And but my education is not the same as the one I give, and or I hopefully provide to others. And I don't think schools are quite the same either. I don't know.
Okay, well, this segues nicely into something else anyway, which is something on Forbes, which is competency-based hiring, 10 signals the shift is happening, which is a clickbait title, but really talks about, you know, 10 links to things which really show that people are more interested in what people can do rather than what they say they can do. So, you know, when I'm talking about open badges, I often talk about CVs and resumes being a bunch of claims, whereas badges are a bunch of evidence, you know, and projects allow you to show what you've done. And I feel like part of the discussion, you know, we could go around in circles around this, because when schools aren't in control of the thing that they're measured on, like, they get to choose which, you know, which exam board to do for this or whatever, and, you know, some courses that they might do Chinese as opposed to French or whatever. But really, they have pretty set parameters in which they operate, and they have to get the highest, as high grade as possible for every student in those things, rather than a much more diverse horizontal way of doing things, rather than everybody in the same vertical silo. So it's interesting that some really good examples here, Accenture, some, you know, big hirers talking about, you know, even Google do this to some extent. Like, we're not particularly interested in your bits of paper, we're interested in what you can do.
Completely. So we've discussed it, like my little brother, for example, who runs a software company, mm-hmm. and is a programmer. When he interviews people, he will get them to bring a piece of their code. He will read it. He will ask them to then explain why they did certain, you applied certain different techniques and how they've done it. And he's not interested whether they finish their degrees or not. If they're good, they're good. If they know the code, they know the code. And he feels he can work with them. That's what they're after.
And we have talked about this before, and we've talked about how it's easier to measure these things and bypass the bits of paper and credentials when the work is, well, to use Mahabali's thing, positivist and demonstrable and all that kind of stuff. So this guy, Ryan Craig, says, quote, top employers announced the end of degree requirements for entry-level jobs, that's Penguin Random House, that they view degrees as a misleading indicator and have decided to conceal the credential from hiring managers, that's Ernst & Young, will not consider school attended, that's Deloitte, or flat-out attack the value of degrees as worthless as a criteria for hiring, that's Google. So I'm always interested in how this applies to people like me. The reason why I decided to get, you know, lots of certificates was partly out of interest, but partly because, to me, they're insurance policies. It's an arms race. Like, how can I differentiate myself in the job market? Or, you know, if I put doctor in front of my name as a consultant, people start listening to me more, or whatever it's going to be. And I guess that if it's done on...
So let me pitch something right at you there. So you've done a PhD. It took you 6 years, 4 years, 5 years,
something like that. Yeah,
very long. But you did it on digital literacies.
Yeah.
And the work that you did on that, you shared on our podcast, and you shared on your blog, and you have a blog. You have a website dedicated to it called Never Ending Thesis.
Yeah.
And it's very public in these sort of online domains, And you did that. You have gone on to work for, you know, during that time, work for JISC and Mozilla, out of teaching to do work for those two companies. And now you set up as an independent consultant. And the work that you are getting, the contracts that you're getting as an independent consultant are in part related to that degree, related to the fact that you are perceived as having expertise in this area that is beyond that of your average Joe, certainly, and indeed most people in the field. The question is it the, you know, the doctor in front of your name, is it the degree certificate that allows people to say, let's hire Doug?
Or is I think It's a mixture of things. It's a signal, isn't it? So yeah. This post talks about signals that a shift's happening, but really, you know, people will hire, you know, young people who have gone to Oxbridge or Ivy League universities because they went to those universities and they recognize that whatever degree they did, they're going to be pretty smart people. Or, oh, hey, you used to work for Google, right? Okay, you're in the door, and they're they're kind of having worked for Google, you know, or having been the assistant to someone famous or whatever. They're non-certification based ways of proving that you can do stuff.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is it doesn't actually solve the problem because you're still basing things on brands rather than what people can do. And so you've got a problem, I think, potentially, which is why I think badges are quite useful. And the more extrovert somebody is, the more likely they are to be able to get a job without using credentials.
Well, that's the interesting gamble, isn't it? Who's going to gamble with that? You went and got the credentials. I got my job not based on my certified credentials, but based on brand, I guess, on experience. And that experience being tested out through phone calls and references and things, and my online presence. I don't know. It's hard to say. One of my tutees this week is applying for Cambridge to do architecture, and he's an amazing automotive designer. So he designs cars, and not that he's built any, but he just designs them. And he has put in, what has he done this week? He's done a portfolio. So I said, why don't you put a portfolio of your work, because it is so very good, into, here we go. So it's henryauto.wixsite.com, Wix being W-I-X. And he's put a portfolio of work together with just all of his diagrams, basically, and that he's done over time. And I'll put a link in the show notes. But it's sort of really impressive. And it's like, it's not, I think it's the standard thing that people should be doing as they move from a transition from one stage of education into another or whatever, is that they should have an identity online and showcase who it is that they are, what they do there. It's easy for him because his work is very impressive, but I don't know.
Yeah, and you know, to some extent, is this just the new normal, and you have to build up that portfolio, and we should be doing that in schools. Well, that could be one route. Another is that that's fine for people like you and me who have spent, you know, more than a decade doing the work that we want to do, and then we can point to things. But for people who are fresh out of the door, how do they point to things they've done? They can only point to it if they've done it in school, can they?
Yeah. That's the truth.
And then how do you... I mean, this is the thing with badges. And so the original thing was everyone's going to have e-portfolios. It's the end of certificates and stuff. But of course, nobody's going to really look through endless numbers of portfolios. They have to have you packaged up in some way, hence badges, etc. This is impressive stuff, I have to say, looking through his portfolio.
No, I mean, this is what I'm saying. His work is amazing. So Fred Boss, hello, Fred, if you're listening, who works in Ireland in EdTech. I put this up on Twitter, which went into Facebook, and he picked up on it and is showing it to teachers today as an example of a digital portfolio. And his work is extraordinary. Anyway.
Good stuff. Right, well, there we are. And then lastly, and just kind of as a bit of fun, I stuck in this Gizmodo link from at the end of last month, and it's the dark web is mostly full of garbage. We haven't mentioned this already, have we?
No.
All right. Well, the thing which I find hilarious about this is, I mean, there's some not safe for work language in here if you're sensitive to these things or being somewhere where your boss is around. But the hilarious thing is someone has gone... There's certain websites, so Onion websites as they're known, where you can only access them if you are using Tor, which is the way in which you bounce your traffic around the web. Mm-hmm. So it's a .onion address. And I've often thought about having one of these just because they're you can't really take them down, like, because they're across the network. And someone's done an analysis about what's on here and has found all sorts of stuff. Some of it is just basically how the web used to be 20 years ago. Some of it is like one page stuff which only has a very, like, has a someone dancing on it. One is just gory and weird, some's conspiracy theories. But for me, some of it is just terrible and should not be seen, like rape and suicide and all that kind of stuff. But to me, like, this is the weird underbelly of the web, and this is what we've lost. I'm not saying that I want to go and visit websites which are called Fatty World and watch videos of hot fatties, as kind of you're being encouraged to on this particular website. But what I am saying is that a world where we have to be very corporate and, you know, present our best selves all the time, and that there's no chance of having multiple personalities and ways of expressing ourselves online, pushes things underground. And the trouble about things being pushed underground, first of all, they're seen as other and as wrong and as dangerous. And secondly, they're just not as accessible to people who haven't got the technical expertise or willingness to go into that dark underbelly.
I'm not.
I can see you're fascinated by some of the stuff.
I'm just looking through it. I do go and have a look at this. It's just like some bonkers stuff. If you've got this far in the podcast, you should go and treat yourself to this, just to reading this post. It's a very simple way to go and see what's in the dark web. And it's mostly full of garbage, and that's it. Do you know what it reminds me of?
What?
It reminds me of sort of MySpace-y kind of profiles.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's just like you have a place on the web, and it basically, the place on the web says, I'm freaky, I'm a freak kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's full of lots of that. It's just kind of freaky. It's kind of freaky stuff. People trying to be freaky, trying to grab your attention by being freaky kind of thing. Trying to, you know, this is my secret page. This is a dildo rotating in front of some clouds. And I'm trying to make you click stuff or just sort of pique your morbid curiosity, maybe. I don't know. You are mad. It's one of these things says it's all a bit sort of left field and bonkers, kind of thing.
The thing which interests me is that there's a quotation which I think is often attributed to Voltaire about, you know, I might not agree with what you say, but I will defend till the death your right to say it. And I think that perfect example of ahistoricism, it was originally, just having quickly Googled it now, was by a female writer, Beatrice Evelyn Hall, but it was being attributed to Voltaire instead. That kind of thing, there's some stuff on here, like I was saying before, like the rape stuff, the suicide stuff, just the tote thing in very bad taste. Like, it's definitely not my thing, and I think it's abhorrent, but at the same time, if people want to do that kind of stuff and it's within the law, like, they should just go ahead and do it. And I feel like there's too much now of people jumping on other people, and I definitely feel it in this world of Trump and Brexit and stuff, like almost censoring each other for, they're basically norming each other. They're basically saying, like, how dare you act different to how the society is supposed to act? And I feel like you should be able to do what you want, and there should be different sides to you, and there should be fun, creative sides and stuff. And I do it in a very boring, kind of getting towards middle-aged white guy kind of way by having multiple blogs. But I think more creative people would do art projects and, like, single-serve websites which were a bit pointless and that kind of thing. And they might be anonymous, and they might not be. But yeah, I like this.
I'll tell you one thing. There's nothing on here in the dark web that they're showing in here, and obviously this has been filtered by whomever wrote this for Gizmodo. But there's nothing on here worse than like a Twitter hate campaign. Some of the horror things I've seen on there are just like awful, and that's how people are getting held account and indeed arrested for it. Things like that. I'd like to, so not unrelated to that, actually, I'd just like to talk about, so today I had a BT engineer coming around this morning to fit a landline to my flat for the second time, and so I wasted him for 5 hours this morning, and he turned up and said, oh, I think we're going to have a site survey done. This is the second engineer, so now we're going to have a survey done, and then we're going to have the engineers come around to actually fit the landline. So well done to the school Wi-Fi for getting tired through its time. And but so I did my lesson with my upper six this morning on Slack. So we have a channel on Slack that me and my colleague are on, and our pupils in the upper six class. And there's only six of them, so it's quite manageable. And we looked at censorship on the internet. So we're looking at censorship across the world and which countries sort of censor it, and then looking at how the United Kingdom, for example, which is listed as one of the enemies of the internet for the censorship that goes within the United Kingdom, but it's not done in at all the same way that China's censorship is done, for example. And so we looked at that, and then I just thought, as I was thinking about this, I thought, do you know, we call it web filtering in school. You block sites, and it's called filtering, and it's called child protection, and it's called this, that, and the other. I'm going to call it censorship from now on. So the internet, the censorship of the internet for our pupils, that's what I'm going to call it. Just so that it gets talked about, I thought it was a much better word to use. The idea of filtering something, you filter something because you want the stuff that you don't want in the thing that you're going to consume to be present. But I think I'm going to call it censorship.
Well, so just unpack that. So when I think of censorship, I think of letters home. So I was reading Montaigne this morning and his essays, and there's different indications in the text as to different versions and which passed the censor and stuff. And then there's the letters that came back from war in the First and Second World War with bits blacked out. That's what I think about censorship. So you're making the point that some bits get through and some bits are blacked out. And on your system, you can see the bits which are not allowed to go to, and therefore it's censorship.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't want... So my system isn't set up. It's not in my control at the moment. But I want it as open as possible. Even more importantly, because nearly 1,000 of our pupils live here. And so I would like it as open as it can be. So someone asked me this morning, why is Imgur blocked? Mm. And I don't really know. I don't use it. So I asked them why. And they said, well, I don't know really, because it's, you know, there is sort of dodgy stuff on there, but mostly it's very useful. And I'm like, okay. It's a form of censorship. It's a form of blocking through a lack of familiarity and knowing of what is really there, and not trusting people, worried that people are going to do the wrong thing rather than trusting them to do the right thing because they know what the right thing is. And therefore to learn about themselves through their own behavior rather than forced behavior, where they learn not about themselves but about systems that are stopping them getting to where they might want to be, or something like that. And that's the sort of twist that I'm taking in it. When people discuss filtering, I don't want them to think about that. They always think they're doing someone a favor. And I want to talk about censorship because it suggests that the more censorship that you have, the worse your system is. And that's appropriate, I think.
Yeah, so I was just trying to think of, you know, the metaphors there in terms of filtering and censorship. So, and there's a setting on Google Chrome for Android, which I didn't realize existed until I saw this morning. It's similar to the one which is in Opera. So you can basically turn on compression on the server side, I think, or when it goes through Google servers. And it just means that it'll make the pages smaller and come to you faster. So that's a bit of a stretch, but it's kind of filtering in the sense of... Well, it's not really filtering, is it? But I'm trying to think of, like you said there, filtering as being something which is benign and something which you're doing for the benefit of the people you're doing it to, versus censorship, which is actually harming the people you're doing it to. That's the point you're trying to make, isn't it?
Yes, this is the thing. So, yes, it is the point I'm trying to make. I want people to be able to make mistakes. I don't want to, I don't want stabilizers on the bike, even though they can ride, basically. I want them to choose and learn about their choices. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But if you look at the consumer-facing devices, like Amazon Fire tablets, some of the stuff that Google's announced, it's all about, hey, we're going to protect your children on the internet by blocking stuff which is bad. And you're just outsourcing the censorship. Yeah?
Yeah. You are. And the only way that goes is bad, in my opinion. Because they have to censor more and more and more because they're one thing trying to cover many things. Whereas if you break that down into less than more than one thing, as in parents rather than an ISP, then you're going to do a better job of it. I like the Google Wi-Fi thing though, being able to turn the Wi-Fi off at a certain time for certain people. That's control that should have been here a long time ago, I think. So I don't have a problem with turning the web off, as long as I have a problem with how it is delivered when it is available. No, that's it.
I think in general, and we're getting onto a different point here, but you know, ages ago I talked about not playing Battlefield anymore because I felt it was hypocritical of, and my son called me out on it, of, you know, playing shooty games. Similar kind of things around etiquette and accessing stuff and whatever. And I feel like if I was going to filter the internet, I think I've still got OpenDNS actually on my router, then it should be filtered for me as well as my son. And if I want to bypass that filtering, it shouldn't be easy for me to do. Otherwise, I should be turning it off for everyone. That kind of thing, like including them as, I don't want to, this is the wrong way of conceptualizing it, as like little adults inside the child waiting to get out is the wrong way of putting it, but that kind of thing, recognizing that they're on a journey towards adulthood rather than infantilizing them until they turn 18 and then they can't cope.
Yes, so it's actually taking away the sort of child-adult dichotomy, isn't it? It's actually saying a child is an adult in development, basically. And if they never taught anything about it, then, you know, then they're never going to learn it properly. And so often, and it's very different. Parenting is a very, very difficult thing. And, you know, I've done it and I wouldn't dream of telling anyone how to do it. I always think it's an interesting discussion, your choices you make as a parent. And we've discussed it here often. But it is. I do think that children are just little people, and they have to learn and they have to grow up, and you can't hide the world from them.
I have to say, one of the reasons why Imgur might be banned, I use it quite a lot, especially for times when I want to host an image somewhere and link to it because the place doesn't allow me to host it in the thing itself, if you know what I mean. But I am just totally staring and scrolling Imgur's never-ending feed now of memes and stuff.
All right.
That's not a reason to block it, is it?
That's a reason to turn it on, not off. People need to learn. Yeah. If it's got good stuff in it, then, you know, that's that. Right.
We said at the same time.
well, that was fun. What are you up to this week?
I haven't got loads of work on at the moment. I have to say, I'm getting slightly concerned that I haven't got enough work. There's several clients who are like either kind of promised me stuff or things were coming up and it hasn't really materialized. So I'm hoping someone's going to give me some more work soon. That'll be quite nice. So yeah, I guess business development, euphemism for finding people to give me money and work. and then I'm getting my flu shot and I was supposed to be going to Jersey, but that hasn't been sorted out. And yes, that's about it. Planning for my wife's birthday. There you go. What are you doing?
It's a very important thing to be doing. I'm going to sort out teacher tech time. 5 o'clock on Fridays, I'm inviting teachers we have a bar in our common room here, in our staff room. And so I'm going to invite teachers down to the bar, and they're going to come and bring any tech issue that's something to do with school business. And so what I figure is that teachers are just like damn busy. And so they hit a tech issue, and it kind of goes in what I've now called everyone's favorite filing cabinet in the term, and I put the word bin in capitals inside cabinet. I thought I was being very clever there. And And they're going to come along, and if they have a genuine tech issue that I can help them solve, like get an email on their phone, or, you know, it could be something really simple and straightforward, or it could be something they're trying to achieve in the classroom with their pupils or whatever, or somewhere their kit doesn't work and no one seems to be responding to their calls or whatever, and they don't really understand why, that sort of thing. And if it's a genuine tech issue, I'm going to give them a token for a pint or a drink next door.
Very good.
So we're going to do that. I got the digital learning party to get rolling. I took the pilot project to the HODs here last Friday, and they came back and said they wanted to do it with the lower six. So I'll be planning that in the next couple of weeks. I've been given permission to use a vacated classroom to put up a green screen wall and make like a media center in there. And so I'll be dealing with all of these projects, I think. Our debates as well, taking the debating society stuff that we do. So every boarding house debates in this school at junior and senior level. So we're recording those and putting them on the web. And so I'll be making sure that project's coming to life.
Good, good, good. Right then. So maybe we'll talk about meritocracy next week. I've got a post coming out, which you, thank you very much, have looked through the draft of. That should be on DML Central either next week or the week after. If you're listening to this and you have suggestions for things for us to talk about, we usually talk about things which are in the current zeitgeist, I guess. Then do let us know. Di is at Di Barnes on Twitter, and I am at DAJ Belshaw. So thank you very much for listening, and we will hear, you'll hear from us again next week.
Have a good week. Bye bye.
I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay.